Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Hey, this is Ryan. Thank you so much for joining me for the Songs of Note podcast. If you listen to this show, you know I love rock biographies and documentaries, and I eat it up. And I love Nirvana, and I really, really love the output of work that Kurt Cobain did, and I find him to be an extremely interesting character with just multifaceted elements of his personality through his work and his writing, and we can see so much of that now and hear so much of it. I have hundreds of Nirvana songs on my computer that I'll listen to from demos to live recordings. You know, it's the bootlegs and stuff that just I get excited about it, because it's not things that were properly released, but they are available. And today we're talking about one of my favorite, one of my very favorite Nirvana songs, and it is the song "You Know You're Right." And I reached out to the writer of Kurt Cobain's biography called "Heavier Than Heaven." And the author's name is Charles R. Cross. And so he and I have been interacting for months over email, just trying to find a time that was going to work. And it finally landed. And gosh, he has a wealth of knowledge and understanding of the situation around Kurt. He's written about him. He was writing about him before they were even famous. So really looking forward to hearing the interview today. I'm going to put a link to that biography in the show notes. It is just, it's probably my favorite rock biography that I've ever read. So if you have not read it, "Heavier Than Heaven" by Charles R. Cross, please check it out. And we're looking at "You Know You're Right." So let's head over to the interview with Charles now. Hey, this is Ryan. I am so excited to be talking with Charles R. Cross. He is the author of "Heavier Than Heaven," the biography of Kurt Cobain, and it's one of my very, very favorite rock biographies. So, Charles, thank you so much for taking time to chat with me today.
You're welcome,
man. So, your book, I've probably read that book more than any other rock bio, and I've read a lot of biographies. And the thing that I loved about it is I feel like you humanized this character who I didn't know at all, obviously, just through the music. And I felt like I had such a deeper appreciation for the work that Kurt Cobain did and that the band did in Nirvana, that I feel like since I read the book, I've listened to more Nirvana than I did prior to reading the book. But I've read it a couple times. I've got it on Audible as well. And it's just such a fantastic book. I'm curious for you, what was the pull to choose him as your subject and to write about?
Yeah. Well, thank you for such kind words. And, I worked on this book, for years. I had been editor of a magazine called The Rocket in Seattle, which was the local music magazine for the Northwest. And, Kurt grew up reading that magazine. When I got a chance to look through his personal effects, I think the thing that touched me the most personally was to see that he had still saved old issues of The Rocket.
Wow.
From when he was a kid. And in some ways, the magazine I was editing, you know, he grew up and wanted to be part of. But Nirvana advertised in The Rocket a number of times looking for drummers. So, and we were really the first place to ever write about him and did the first cover story on Nirvana before they were famous. So he was our turf, or my turf, as a writer who wrote about Northwest music history. I often have people say, well, how well did you know him? And the truth was, I didn't know most of the people we wrote about in the paper personally, because I was the critic reviewing them. I met him on a few occasions at meet and greets or record store release for Nevermind, and saw the band a number of times. But in any case, his death struck me and upset me tremendously, as it did everybody in the Northwest. But in terms of writing a biography about him, even though I'd written a number of articles, after his death, there immediately were books and magazine articles. There was one book that came out less than a week after Kurt died that had been written over the weekend following his death.
Gosh.
So, but many of these stories that came out just didn't tell the story with the right flavor or, with Kurt, it's really a struggle for any writer. He's such a larger than life figure,
mm-hmm.
but that to humanize him and not make him a god or
right.
a Christ-like figure or that, many of the books just focused on reporting stories from stuff that hadn't been fact-checked.
Mm.
So my goal in doing this book was to write a book that where I went back and got original sources. I didn't rely on other articles that had been written. I didn't rely on what Kurt said because he was an unreliable narrator, as we say.
Yeah.
And I went and found original sources and tried to tell the story of his life from that. But I'd written a previous book on just the album Nevermind, and it was research for that made me think, you know, there is so much to his story that hadn't been told. And so I dug into it. I think it took me almost 4 years to complete this book. Mm. So it was a monolithic task that doesn't even feel like it's over.
Hmm.
Even, you know, now I still have ongoing research into Kurt's life that shows up in my world.
Huh. That's interesting. Well, and I do, I just appreciate the angle that you took in the way that you described him, because I certainly have read those articles or books where they do elevate him to like a mythical status or something. And it's like, this was a guy. This is a really talented and interesting, fascinating guy, but he's a guy. But I feel like you had empathy in the angle that you presented him. And so I really enjoyed it. And so today we're talking about You Know You're Right, which is such a haunting song. It's one of my very favorite Nirvana songs. But I'm wondering if you can kind of talk about the landscape of what was happening around the band in January 94. So in February 93, they recorded In Utero. They did Unplugged later that year in November 93. And then in January 94, the band got together over 3 days, January 20th, 29th, and 30th. Cobain wasn't there for the first 2 days, so that was just Dave Grohl and Chris recording some stuff. And then on January 30th, they got together and recorded You Know You're Right. And I'm curious if you can just talk about like just the landscape of all of some things that were going on around in their lives at that time. I know both Dave and Chris had said it was a weird time in the band in general.
Well, it absolutely was a weird time in the band. You know, one of the things I think when you try to tell the story of Kurt's life, you go up against people that don't understand addiction or don't understand the landscape of the struggles of depression and let's just be honest, call it mental illness that Kurt struggled with. So, even trying to research his life, there became a point where I went back to a couple of my original sources and said, hey, I've got Kurt saying in these interviews that he was doing really well or that he was off drugs and that, et cetera. And that's not adding up with some of the other stories. Is it possible? When was he sober? And the response of some of the people that knew Kurt the best were duh, you know, and basically I was failing to understand the lens of addiction, which dominates the addict's life in every way possible. And with Kurt, the truth was that last year of his life was just a disaster. And there really was not more than a week of that last year that he was able to grab sobriety. He said in a number of interviews, I've been sober for X number of days. He said, I've never been happier in my life.
Mm-hmm.
He said that a month before he took his own life. But as I said, he wasn't a reliable narrator, and he told the story of his band and his life as if he had it together, because rock stars don't tell journalists how screwed up they are.
Right.
There just isn't an honesty to that. They're selling music and selling themselves. So the truth was, Kurt's life in January was really coming off the rails.
Mm.
He bought a new house. But he didn't really want to do the tour that they were forced to do. He didn't really want to do anything.
Hmm.
He was so caught up in a daily pattern of addiction that getting him to do anything was really an accomplishment. And yet, there were things he did during that time. He did create music. He did write some new songs. He did do some sessions. There is musical material that I have heard that has never come out that he worked on. So it wasn't that he did nothing, but it the idea that he was kind of pulling it together is just not true. Mm. There is no evidence that there was a sustained period of him pulling it together. So these sessions, as you said, happened in January, and they go in, and Kurt brings this song. The song, you know, you're right, was not a brand new song. Kurt had worked on it kind of on and off for about a year. He played it, if I'm remembering the date correctly off the top of my head, and I could be wrong, it was like October 23rd, 1993.
That's it.
He played the song at a show in Chicago.
Chicago, yep.
And titled it at that point On the Mountain, and which is interesting, you know. But you know, there was other stuff he played during the course of In Utero. There would be bits of songs that we later heard that would be cobbled together. So Kurt had been working on the song for a while. He brought it in. It, as you said, it is a remarkable song. Mm. You know, I think I write in Heavier Than Heaven. It's the last great song. and personally, I think it may, In Utero might be Kurt's finest artistic achievement in terms of songwriting. Yep. Clearly, Nevermind is the commercial album. Yep. But You Know You're Right stands in my mind with the top 10 songs that Kurt wrote.
Me too.
I could go on and on.
No, man, that's
me off.
No, I love it. I love it. We are so on the same page with that stuff. I'm curious on, you said that you had heard some of the recordings from that time. I read that the band also did some additional recordings from the day they recorded You Know You're Right. That I think Chris Novoselic, if I remember the quote, he said, I kept it, like he has the tape, and he said, I kept it like a secret. Some speculation on those songs were one called The Sun, one called Ivy League. There's a couple others with just speculation that maybe they recorded it. Have you heard any of the recordings from that day with Kurt singing?
No comment.
Okay.
If I go into that, then it creates an internet rabbit hole.
And
all I can say and be upfront is I've heard material that hasn't come out. And everybody, I think, then speculates that there's an incredible amount of wonderful material and there's a great lost album.
Mm.
And I don't think there's a great lost album. There is solo material and rehearsals and other things that have not come out that maybe could be made into an album. Mm. But there is not a great lost Nirvana album.
Gotcha.
So just to put the period on that, I think because of Kurt's death, people are so desperate to hear that voice again.
Right. That's
and to
it.
Hear something.
That's
you
it.
Know, what is there that I love this music so much, and what else is there another song that I can love as much as I love In Bloom?
Yeah.
That can make my life better.
Hmm.
But there in the vaults, there is not another In Bloom that I am aware of. You Know You're Right, I think, ends up being even more remarkable because it's essentially full on Kurt Cobain and his last cry, so to speak. I don't want to be too overdramatic. When you have a guy that's going to die 3 months later, anything you say can sound kind of, a little too overdramatic.
Sure.
But this truly is full throttled Kurt, the singing, the song structure, the power of the song, the way it leaves you. This is really his last masterpiece.
Mm. Well, I'm curious about the lyrics. Cause like you said, after the fact, once we knew that he died, then it makes you, at least I start looking at the lens through everything that he did through. Is he talking about that? Is he talking about suicide? So like the lyrics on this song, I'm curious if you think that he was actually talking about that when he's saying things like, I will move away from here. I will crawl away for good. I always knew it would come to this. Like, when you start looking at it like that, it's like, oh my gosh, it sounds like a cry for help. And he's singing, I've never, you know, I feel pain. He's screaming pain. Do you think he's actually referencing that? I mean, I know we have no way of knowing, but.
Well, yes. But I also think that you can read way too much into his lyrics. And there ends up being this idea that if I figure his lyrics out, I can figure out what was happening with him and I can trace it.
Yeah.
And every songwriter I know says that when they write a song, and Leonard Cohen writes a song called Suzanne Takes Me Down, you know, he's referencing a real person to some degree in his song that was inspired, but lyrics and songs are not pieces of nonfiction. So, and with Kurt, people look at it like it's a talisman. If I have a magnifying glass on this, I can figure out where he was when and what he was trying to say. And let's go back and look at every song Kurt wrote basically after Sliver. Is not every single Nirvana song from Sliver on, to some degree, a cry for help, so to speak? They all are, you know. I mean, there are four or five songs on Nevermind that reference guns. I mean, this is not a great mystery that here was a man who struggled with depression, struggled with drug addiction, struggled with suicide, ideology, these are in every song. So I think it, putting too much focus on You Know You're Right as if this was a sign of his, you know, dissension into madness, I think the answer is yes, it is. But I think so are all the songs on In Utero, and so are the other things he said in interviews and the way he lived his life. You know, I think, again, the argument that I push back against, and there are unstable people who look at Kurt's life and want to find anything, anyone to blame other than him for the betrayal that he did to them by taking his own life. And they want to piece it all together and they want to blame someone else. But, you know, the life of an addict and the life of addiction, in Kurt's case, about 3.5 years of pretty hardcore addiction, this is not a pretty story. In the end, you can blame many people, but you ultimately have to give Kurt some level of personal responsibility for the choices he made, both in the addiction and in his suicide and various suicide attempts. The thing that's most absurd to me is people saying, you know, that the circumstances of his death can't be suicide. You have someone who attempted suicide or had near suicide drug overdoses a dozen times. A dozen times he's essentially dead. And then we want to say on the 13th time, that wasn't like the others. That was some nefarious exterior forces. It's not even worth starting to go down. But we were on the topic of, are the lyrics of In Utero kind of precedent of death? And they are, but so are so many of the other songs. And the fact that we know the lyrics were written over the course of a year, this is not Kurt sitting down and writing a suicide note in January of 1994. There are plenty of suicide notes in his journals already, or things that basically are that. Let's not read too much into the song lyrics here.
Got it. Well,
my take to go off on that is that the song lyrics are a little bit more about Kurt's like anger at the system, anger at not being understood, anger at everything from his parents to corporate rock to, I will take my toys and go home, where I will finally be recognized. I think that theme is very common in Kurt from being a teenager. I think it ultimately springs from the idea of, I'm in a world that's not understanding, recognizing, or loving me. And those lyrics of I don't feel recognized or understood, they're in so many songs. But in this song, they are very upfront. Let's also read to the fact that Kurt wasn't in an ideal marriage. I don't know anyone who is. There was significant financial, but I'm not someone who believes the song is about one particular person.
Got it. You hit on a couple things that made me think of my next question. And when I started looking at the dates, and I was looking at having read your book, you mentioned this earlier that Kurt talked about suicide in the past, and then I believe even as a teenager, there was somebody that quoted him as saying, "I'm gonna go out like Jimi Hendrix." He thought that Hendrix had committed suicide at the time. I'm gonna be a famous rock star. I don't remember if he said at 27 or not, but obviously there's the 27 stigma. When I went and looked at the dates, it looked like Kurt turned 27, and it was 11 days later that Rome happened. And people question if Rome was a suicide attempt or not with the overdose. Do you think that was a suicide attempt or no?
Yes. You have a guy here at some point that's taking Rohypnol.
Right.
It's in a blister pack. It's not like you accidentally popped out extra ones. Mm. Every one he took, he had to methodically pop out. He writes a suicide note.
Yeah.
It's one of several suicide attempts. Yes, Rome was a suicide attempt. If there's one Three Stooges aspect of the end of Kurt's life that is most, excuse my French, fucked up, it's the fact that his management or a variety of people around him, and fueled by Kurt himself, didn't want to call Rome a suicide attempt. Calling it an accidental drug overdose from the start worked against Kurt.
Yeah.
The thought was that you'd protect his privacy, you'd protect his chance to get to treatment, you'd protect the band's commercial world. But it worked in opposite of all those. If it had been mentioned that Kurt's death was a suicide, and people close to Kurt, even in the band, were not initially told it was a suicide attempt. Mm. That really worked against him.
Right.
You have to admit someone's sick before you can get help.
Mm.
And everyone around Kurt knew he was sick, and choices were made that were not, that in the end did not prove correct. But that's armchair quarterbacking, a loss of a life.
Yeah.
We also have to, again, take much personal responsibility towards Kurt because of the way he dealt with it as well.
Gotcha. Well, I'm curious about the state of events. If for people who don't know, the song was recorded in January 94, and then it's 9 years before it comes out with legal things, with all kinds of the band interaction. Courtney Love, you know, everybody has an opinion on it. I don't even know my question other than, like, what was the big holdup? Don't you think everybody wanted this thing out, or do you think in the end it was just the money and making sure the right people were getting paid what they should for it to be released?
No, totally not that. Mm. I mean, I'll take some personal responsibility. Having heard the song, I basically lobbied everyone and said, "You've got to put this thing out."
Mm.
You know, but there was. The people around Kurt, the songs that he had, it's not like they don't approach it or haven't approached it the way the fan base does.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas everything Kurt does as a music fan, I'm dying to hear more Nirvana.
Right, please.
Right now.
Yeah.
Still today.
Yeah.
Please give me something.
Right.
But when you know him as a person and you're dealing with the outgrowth of that, there's a jewel sitting there, but you're not thinking of it as a jewel. You're thinking there were 1,000 jewels inside this house that I experienced and dealt with. And one song doesn't stand out to the people that knew Kurt and grew up with him and, loved him and were around him. So you can't blame one character in this you can't blame, Chris, Courtney, Dave, management. There's no one reason that the song didn't come out. It was complicated. It took a while. There was behind the scenes lobbying that happened, and it came out.
Mm-hmm. Thank goodness.
And and people really liked it, which made me happy.
Yeah.
Then I was like, okay, I've been raving about the song forever.
Right.
and I feel some level of vindication that that everyone else realizes it's a great song as well, and it was a hit. I think what's most notable, though, is that when you heard that song on the radio again, it was like you're hearing that same voice.
Yep.
So to imagine in a basement of a studio in North Seattle, you know, Kurt was there singing that song.
Yeah.
God, what are we going back to now? 26 years ago? Am I doing the math correctly, or am I off?
I think that's right.
By a decade, I could be. But that's just utterly amazing to think about. Yeah, the song came out. It was widely heralded as a great Nirvana track, and the album sold well. And you know, we have seen since Nirvana, Nevermind and Utero come out in more expanded editions.
Yeah, which is cool.
We have seen some new music of Kurt's come out in the documentary.
Yeah.
So people have heard a few new things.
Yeah.
I don't believe that anytime soon there's going to be a lost Nirvana album coming out. But you know, I think that's the saddest aspect of Kurt's life, other than losing him as a human being.
Right.
But we also lost the other music that we had hoped to hear. The songs he had written and not recorded, the ideas he had in his head that hadn't been together, the things the band had jammed through in rehearsals that never were recorded or weren't complete. We lost all that when we lost him. Even a Kurt and a Nirvana that might have been broken up at the end,
right. They
still could have gone together and hobbled together another album. But the way that events happened, that last upcoming Nirvana album, that was mostly in Kurt's mind. We never got a chance to hear that.
Yeah. Well, thankfully we do have the recordings that they have released, and the band has put out a ton. And like you had said, so for people listening, man, there's some great, the with Lights Out box set, there's tons of gems on there. But Charles, I just appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on to talk about the song. For people who want to check out Charles's website, it's charlesrcross.com, and the book is Heavier Than Heaven. And thank you so much, Charles. It's an honor getting to talk with you, and especially for how much I love the book. I just appreciate your time so much today. Thank you.
Thank you for your kind words.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.